Welcome back to Vocal Point. I'm Jerry Newcomb, and right now we have the privilege to talk with Dr. Jay Richards, who is the author of some books. He's an intellectual thinker. He used to work with the Acton Institute, and for the last year or so, he's been involved in something called thestream.org. It's almost like a Christian version, if you will, of the Drudge Report. Jay, welcome to the program.
Thanks, Jerry. Thanks for having me.
And tell us about this, thestream.org.
Absolutely. It actually is a project that grew out of a partnership that I have with James Robison, who is a popular Christian evangelist who has had a longtime TV show with his wife, Betty, called Life Today, and he has a large ministry called Life Outreach International that digs wells, actually, for people in the third world.
Wow.
James and I did a book together in 2012 called Indivisible, and the book is designed to do a couple of things. One, to say that the social issues, things like marriage and religious liberty and abortion, and economic issues like taxes and free trade really go together, that you can't isolate these things and say, well, let's just talk about morality and not economics or vice versa. Those things are in many ways indivisible. But also that it is Christians, if we want to have an impact on the public square, we've got to learn to work together. James is an evangelical and I'm a Catholic, and we think that part of the reason we've lost the culture is that Christians are divided up into thousands of different isolated silos. We're either not working together, and then sometimes we're actually even working across purposes, whereas the secular left has been very good at working in concert with each other. And we think that's part of the reason secularism has so overtaken the public square and our public institutions. So the book is really a call for Catholics and evangelicals, for Christians of different traditions, to come together around those principles that we share in common, and to sort of build a common platform. Well, after that book came out in 2012, we thought, you know, we really need to continue doing things like this, and worked and talked and prayed for a couple of years and decided to launch The Stream, which is an online news portal that publishes a lot of original commentary and news. We also syndicate some columnists, and then also, as you said, a little bit like the Drudge Report in that we do aggregate some news, though that's only a small part of what we do. But our conviction is that there's so much good stuff out there. In fact, the information available proliferates every year. That part of the important function in providing news and information is the kind of editorial and screening function to find the best stories that are out there wherever they are and to bring them to readers. So that's what we're trying to do 24/7, actually, at stream.org.
You know, it's interesting, too, in past attempts where Catholics and evangelicals have been in discussion with each other, sometimes there is almost a push to paper over real and genuine differences, and I think that's not good theologically. I mean, let's agree to disagree, but then let's agree to work together for the common good in those areas where we do agree, and there is a great deal of, you know, places where we can agree.
That's exactly right. I mean, I am sort of acutely aware of that. I mean, if you think about the early attempts at ecumenism from things like the National Council of Churches, what ended up happening is that people just sort of basically surrendered all the important theological convictions, and the National Council of Churches just ended up being some, you know, religious people that came together around a liberal political agenda, and that's not what we wanted to do at all. We didn't want to have a National Council of Churches over on the right.
Right.
And so what we said we were going to do is we're going to be, you know, if you're a Presbyterian, you can bring the fact that you're Presbyterian to the platform. You know, if somebody's a Catholic writer, they can write as a Catholic. But we do, as an editorial mission, say let's do our best to develop arguments and focus on issues that actually can bring us together, but not ignore theology. And so theology and apologetics and all that is actually a part of the content of The Stream. If you come to The Stream, you might find a piece about Obama's work in Syria right alongside something about evidence for the resurrection. And that's what makes us different from a lot of other conservative publications. You have publication like National Review, for instance, there's a lot of Christians there, and there's a lot of religious people, but the theology as content is always kind of in the background, or it's actually in the foreground for us.
Hmm. Yeah, very good. All right, let's talk about this idea where you have, let's say, the establishment Republicans who would say, let's focus on economics, we can focus on defense, but forget the social issues. What is your comment to that?
I think it's just completely misguided. I mean, the first thing is that lots of people, including lots of voters, are actually animated by the so-called social issues. I think of my wife, for instance. She actually doesn't care a lot about tax policy or any of those things. I mean, she doesn't like socialism and would notice it if it was bad. But the reality is, if, say, the Republicans decided to change the party platform on marriage or mm-hmm. on life. Mm-hmm. It's not that my wife and millions of people like her would suddenly vote for Democrats. They just wouldn't vote. They wouldn't sort of see the point because they have a hierarchy of values, and things like marriage and life and religious liberty are the biggies. And I honestly think that way too many, if we want to call them establishment Republicans, don't actually know that. They don't get it, that that's how millions and millions of people think. And so they think that, well, you know, it's not like these conservative people are going to go vote for the Democrat. Well, that may be true, but they don't realize that if they completely discourage voters like that, it's, you know, it's going to mean that they're not going to vote for anybody and they're going to end up losing elections. The other thing is that we think that these issues are actually connected philosophically and morally. I mean, you can't have a free market system, for instance, unless you have a populace that's at least minimally virtuous. If everybody steals from everybody else, you can't have a free market system. If you have a government that's utterly corrupt and won't enforce the rule of law, you're not going to get a free market. And so the idea that you can isolate moral and social issues from economic issues, we just think that's philosophically and politically naive. And in fact, if you look at the details, what you find is that it's the same philosophical ideas that justify defense of unborn human rights that justifies the good of economic freedom. These things descend from the same ideas.
You know, you remind me of the quote from John Adams, our second president, one of the framers of the country. He said, "Our Constitution was made for a moral and religious people. It is wholly inadequate to the government of any other."
That's exactly the point. I mean, this is coming from Adams, who is a Unitarian, though is very much a moral traditionalist.
May I stop you right there? Unitarians in 1800 were not anywhere near as liberal as, say, a Unitarian
right.
today. So there is a professed belief in Jesus, even as a divine being, but not, you know, in the full Trinity.
They weren't Trinitarians.
Correct.
Yeah, they weren't Trinitarians, but they weren't the kind of Unitarian that is, you know, is a sort of California hippie today. Exactly right. And so, and all the founders, if you look at them, their discussion on this, wherever they were on the details of theology, they may not have been, in some cases, Orthodox Trinitarians, nevertheless understood the value both of religion and of morality for culture. And this is something that I think many of our libertarian friends these days don't understand. They think that you can actually have a free market, you can have limited government, you can have low levels of corruption in government and courts, but not have religion and not have any kind of virtue in the population. Well, the virtue has to be taught and it has to come from somewhere. And so I'm constantly encouraging my libertarian friends that, look, if you actually believe in limited government and free markets, you need to take Christianity seriously and you need to take virtue and morality seriously.
All right, we're talking right now with Dr. Jay Richards. He's the publisher of The Stream, thestream.org. And Jay, let's talk about the issue of religious freedom, which is near and dear to your heart and my heart as well.
I mean, I honestly think many of us had been talking about this for years. I know you've written on it and been writing about it for years, but in many ways I think 2015 will go down as a watershed year for religious liberty. I mean, the thing I can't quit thinking about is President Obama's Solicitor General before the Supreme Court, when he was asked, okay, look, if we say that people have a constitutional right to same-sex marriage, isn't this going to cause trouble for religious institutions and organizations that still believe in traditional marriage? He didn't deny it. He didn't lie. He said, yeah, we're going to have to look at that.
That's an issue.
This is sort of a subtle threat now hanging over us that if you've got a nonprofit private organization that continues to understand marriage as it's always been understood, there's an implicit threat that you could have your nonprofit status taken away, which for many organizations is essentially a death threat.
Mm-hmm. You know, let's focus on that a little bit more, because I understand some of the Christian schools now are in the crosshairs, if you will, of the militant homosexual activists.
Absolutely. I mean, if you go back a couple of years ago and people were, you know, conservatives were saying, look, if the Supreme Court declares a so-called right to same-sex marriage, it's going to lead to attacks on private religious institutions. The gay activists were saying, absolutely not. We don't want to do anything. We don't want to force people into this. We just want the freedom to marry and to love whom we want to love. It didn't take 48 hours for the Supreme Court to issue its decision before private organizations already started feeling the heat. And we're seeing it in private schools in the Northeast. We're seeing it in the Southwest, private schools, private hospitals, who are essentially being forced to heal on this thing. I mean, if you think about it, if saying that two men or two women can't marry is the moral equivalent of racism, right, and of an advocacy of slavery, then it doesn't make any sense that the public or that the government would actually tolerate that, because it'd just be simply irrational bigotry. So they can't say, beforehand that if you oppose same-sex marriage, you're merely a bigot, and then afterwards say, but of course you're free to do that, and we're not going to punish you. I mean, we should expect that we will essentially be treated, Orthodox Christian organizations that maintain the truth about marriage, that will be treated the same way that Bob Jones University was treated in the 1960s. It will be treated as essentially a pariah that has its tax-exempt status removed because it's in violation of what is sort of settled federal civil law, civil rights law.
And this is a major irony, because the Constitution explicitly in the First Amendment grants religious freedom. Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof. Nowhere does the Constitution grant the right of two men, let's say, to marry each other. And yet the Supreme Court essentially trumped what was explicitly written in favor of what their penumbra is emanating from, you know, whatever. In other
right.
words, what was amorphously supposedly there in the right to privacy and, you know, rights that aren't really expelled out in the Constitution. So it's really it was a terrible decision, and its ramifications are even worse.
Well, it is staggering, because, I mean, really what's happened in the Supreme Court in their decision is that they essentially are saying, you are not allowed, you American citizens are not allowed to say that the maleness or femaleness of a person has anything at all to do with the institution of marriage. I mean, it's quite staggering. So there's no relevant difference between what a man and a woman can do and what two men or two women can do. And so they're essentially supposed to be, in our language and our laws, at war with biological reality, at war with a reality that every culture at every time and place has noticed. And so that something that's frankly that totalitarian, that attempts to transform the language by which we describe reality, we shouldn't imagine that that's sort of a mouse that can be kept in a little box. It's going to get loose. It's a very radical decision. It's going to work itself through our institutions. We should expect to see polyamory. We should expect to see group marriage and polygamy. We should expect to see incest, because the rational basis for a marriage between two people, it was based on the idea that you need exactly one man and one woman to mate. When the rational basis of that idea has been undercut, then there's no rational basis in law for limiting marriage to two people, or even to two human beings for that matter. And so I honestly think we should expect all of those things to follow as night follows day.
Now, when it comes to the people and same-sex marriage, it's my understanding that on the one hand, the polls have definitely shown a shift in the majority, you know, the majority of the American people, a slight majority apparently now favors same-sex marriage. However, when it's been put on the ballot, in most of the cases, with a few exceptions here and there,
right,
it has been voted overwhelmingly, even in liberal states, that people wanted to define marriage as one man, one woman, and yet this has been essentially brought on by judicial fiat. The courts have overruled the people, the will of the people.
That's right. I mean, even in 2012, when I was still living in Washington State, we had a vote, a marriage referendum, and it was put to vote. Well, the pro-same-sex marriage side spent about 10 times what the pro-real marriage side spent, and we still just barely lost. And this was in Washington State, which is very much a blue state. And so what I think has happened is that the public has just simply been worn down on this issue, and so they're willing to say, okay, whatever, you know, live and let live, do your own thing. But I do think there's some buyer's remorse on the part of a lot of people in the public, some of the recent polls I've seen, when they've discovered that this was never about live and let live. This is about changing institutions and changing our very understanding of human reality, and that people that continue to disagree are going to be punished. And so when you see these private businesses like the Memories Pizza parlor in Indiana, punished simply for having particular beliefs that they weren't even exercising, I think a lot of people will start seeing and are starting to see
right.
that the implications for same-sex marriage go way beyond just what two people do in the privacy of their home.
Well, take the example of Sweet Cakes by Melissa. I'm sure you're aware of what happened
Absolutely.
To them just last month.
Yes, it's just absolutely outrageous. And I mean, and even some liberals have admitted that, you know, a above $100,000 fine for a small family bakery simply because they declined to cater a lesbian marriage. I mean, this is just absolutely bizarre. I mean, you can imagine the crimes that you could commit in the state of Oregon for which the fine would be less than $135,000, and yet this poor couple has been essentially, or would have been, bankrupted by this, except that there was fortunately a public funding campaign and they were able to raise the funding to pay for that. But I do think ultimately that I certainly hope that that law is overturned and that this is ruled to be excessive punishment. It's really bizarre, but it shows you how intense and how ultimately totalitarian the movement is on the other side of this issue. That people aren't even, not only are we not allowed to articulate our beliefs that we hold, but we're not even apparently allowed to think them. Even merely having the beliefs is enough to be punished.
Wow. And you know what's amazing, too, it's my understanding that they declined to pay this because they didn't think it was right that they would have to pay this fine. And then the government finally stepped in December and froze their bank accounts or whatever. So at Christmas time, they weren't even able to get money out from their own ATM.
That's exactly right. They looked and it turns out their account had just been, it had been emptied out. So the state of Oregon, is acting in many ways like, say, East Germany acted before the collapse of the Soviet Union. It really is quite bizarre. And you don't see this in any other issue. You wouldn't see this on any other issue. You wouldn't see it for drunk driving, for shoplifting. The level of kind of sort of the draconian degree to which these things are enforced, I think is I'm hoping going to start waking people up to the reality of the situation.
Unfortunately, though, most people don't even know about this story and the level of it. And by the way, I specifically asking about Sweet Cakes by Melissa, and I've had the privilege of interviewing them a few times for D. James Kennedy Ministries, and they're very sweet. And anyway, Gary Bauer made a very fascinating point. He said, imagine going to bed in America and you wake up in Russia. And that's what it was like for Aaron and Melissa Klein of Sweet Cakes by Melissa, because they, in good conscience, just couldn't make a cake to celebrate something they didn't agree with. They thought that this is wrong according to the Bible. I would hope more liberals would wake up and say, you know what, let's agree to disagree, but not, you know, have all these totalitarian type of punishments against people we disagree with.
Well, I would hope that, too. And Andrew Sullivan, there have been a few honest liberals that said, look, I support same-sex marriage, but I'm not signing up for this sort of thing. Unfortunately, I think they're very much in the minority. If you know, anybody that kind of follows queer studies and queer theory knows that it is ultimately totalitarian. It's sort of postmodern and relativist, and they think, look, nobody really has the truth. There is no truth, and so therefore we're free to impose our own. That stuff's been happening, unfortunately, for decades in the academy. It's finally found its way into our courts and into actual legal decisions. And so really at the moment, my only hope is that enough people actually see cases like the Klein's, like the Memories Pizza, like the incident with Kim Davis in Kentucky, and begin to realize that, look, this, if you think you were just being a good libertarian and want people to let people do what they want to do, that is not what this has ever been about.
When you use that term queer studies, that sounds pejorative to me, but is that the term they use?
It is. That is actually the term. And so, of course, the word queer was originally a pejorative term, and I would certainly never use that word. But what's funny is, and this is an interesting kind of fact about, you know, the sort of homosexual community in the United States and in the West, is that they eventually actually decided to own that word. And so there's a kind of irony in it, in owning it. But now it's so far along that the sort of area that focuses on these issues, and it's usually literary theory, dedicated to deconstructing texts and essentially rereading texts in, you know, famous pieces of literature in light of a kind of queer or homosexual worldview. But that's the name of the field. I wouldn't say queer studies, except that that's the official name for it.
All right, we're talking with Dr. Jay Richards, best-selling author. He's also the publisher or the executive editor of The Stream, thestream.org. Dr. Richards, let's talk about the 2016 election. I can't help but think of the phrase from the book, the title of a book by Dr. Richard Land from a few years ago, The Divided States of America. Isn't that the case? I mean, even on the liberal side of things, you've got Bernie Sanders is really creeping up there, giving Hillary Clinton competition. And then, of course, on the Republican side, you have Trump way ahead of the pack on the one hand. And then on the other hand, you have Ted Cruz, you know, yapping at his heels, and maybe even ahead of him in Iowa. So let's talk about the 2016 election, and let's begin by asking you for your comment on the Trump phenomenon. By the way, let me just say this.
Yeah.
Pat Buchanan made a very interesting point. He said Trump, Ben Carson, and Ted Cruz are strong examples, and also Bernie Sanders, would be strong examples of the fact that this is kind of like an anti-establishment election.
I really do think that's what's going on. I mean, I think people both on the left and on the right are frustrated. I mean, I live in the Washington, D.C. area, and I know how quickly and easily it is for people to sort of be assimilated into the Washington machine, in which they're, you know, the high-level connections they have both in government and in the world of business, people become intoxicated with it. And so you can have people like Hillary Clinton who give these speeches railing against Wall Street, but if you actually look at the policies and the things she does, she's more than happy to exercise favor on behalf of her cronies that like her in Wall Street. And this is something I think people are sick of. So I do think that's one major ingredient in the 2016 election. But I do also think that Donald Trump is sort of a force unto himself. I mean, he is someone that, you know, has a very, very popular television show for many years. He's probably the most recognized person in the United States. I understand he's one of the most recognized people on the planet. And so when you have someone like that, it's like having a giant super black hole right in the middle of the solar system. It just sort of transforms things. And then add to that the fact that I think Trump is willing to say and does often say what a lot of people are thinking and would like to have someone say, but that no establishment politician is willing to say. And so I think he benefits from that. I do think if things work out well, this could ultimately be beneficial to Republicans because, for instance, on immigration, he says things that are so extreme that he sort of expands the window of the debate so that someone else can step in and say something, and then they seem quite moderate. And so that's, you know, that's left to be seen. I myself will be concerned if Donald Trump ends up the Republican nominee, but at the moment, I think it's gathering a lot of attention, and I do think he's continues to be the front runner in most polls, except perhaps at the moment in Iowa, because a lot of other people have their votes divided among six or seven other perfectly good candidates. So it's not like there's an obvious Christian candidate or an obvious evangelical candidate or anything like that. So I do think until several of the other people down ticket drop out, Trump will continue to be ahead in most polls.
You know, I think that I might challenge you on just that last point about an obvious Christian candidate. It seems like Ted Cruz might very well fit that category. I mean, here's a guy that, contrary to what you had said, when they come to Washington, D.C., you know, they usually just assimilate and accommodate and they get, you know, conformed to the mold of Washington, D.C. And yet Ted Cruz, you know, he made a lot of enemies, unfortunately, even within his own party, by saying we need to defund Obamacare. Remember that? He did the whole
thing,
and he read Green Eggs and Ham when his children were going to sleep and stuff. But I think Ted Cruz is a type of hero to Christians, both evangelical and Catholic. I really do.
No,
at
I
this
do
point.
Too. I think that a lot of rallying around him. Just looking at polls, though, they're not exclusively, you know, even if you just take evangelicals, they're not exclusively at least the moment saying they're going to pull the lever for Cruz. And the reason is I think you have people like Marco Rubio and Ben Carson, who a lot of people still really like. And so it sort of confounds the variables. I think if, for instance, Ben Carson and a few other people, Mike Huckabee and some of those down ticket actually were to drop out, I think we would see enough of a consolidation around another of the candidates that it would bring Donald Trump down into number two or number three.
Hmm. Yeah, it's a very interesting race to watch, and I've been surprised at Jeb Bush. Now, Jeb Bush, on the one hand, is perceived as being establishment, but as a resident of Florida, I thought he did a great job, you know. And by the way, when he first announced in 1994, before he, you know, he won in 1998, but he first announced, you know what his avenue was to tell the world that he was running for governor? He went on the local Christian stations, various Christian stations, including this very station that I'm interviewing you on, which was founded by the late D. James Kennedy. Now it's the internet version of it, Vocal Point on GraceNetRadio.com. But he came to this studio, and I remember somebody called up and said, asked him the two questions of D. James Kennedy, you know, if you died, do you think you'd go to heaven? And he said, I'm not sure of that. But then the second question was, if you did die and you stood before God and he said, why should I let you into heaven? What would you say? And he said, well, I believe in Jesus Christ and he died for my sins. And, you know, that's the most important question. And he gave the most important answer. So Jeb Bush, somehow, though, somewhere between that time to the present is perceived as this just pro-establishment and stuff.
Yeah.
He had a very solid conservative record. I don't know what happened to him.
In fact, I think we've got several of the candidates that are like that, that are both serious conservatives and serious Christians, and in any other year, any one of them would be identified as that. But I do think points go to people that are more rhetorically anti-establishment, such as Ted Cruz and Donald Trump, than would perhaps be in any other year.
Okay, good point. All right, we have just a few minutes to wrap up. We've kind of been all over the place. How about a quick comment about life and how important the issue of abortion is?
I honestly think this year was also really 2015 seminal on the issue of abortion and life. The Center for Medical Progress and David DeLeiden and the good folks there exposed the ghoulishness and, frankly, the evil of this organization, Planned Parenthood. What's going to happen long term, we don't know. But we're now in a position where no one will be able to say that they did not know what Planned Parenthood is doing. We know what they're doing. We know the kind of evil that they're involved in. We're still funding them at the federal level to a tune of $500 million a year. And I certainly hope that the kind of awareness that has been raised by these Planned Parenthood videos produced by the Center for Medical Progress will play a positive role in the election in 2016 and ultimately lead to us defunding Planned Parenthood at the federal level.
How can evangelicals understand this current pope?
The Pope is a very complicated man. I think he's a sincere believer. If you listen to his Wednesday audiences, he talks about the devil. He talks about the importance of faith and salvation. But he's also a man that was raised in Argentina in a regime that was run first by Juan Perón and then his widow and then other Peronist thinkers up
to the present day. Who were kind of communists, right?
Yeah, it's not communism or socialism, it's Peronism, and it's essentially a kind of anti-capitalist rhetoric in which you have elites, but they use populist rhetoric in order to take power. And I think the Pope Francis doesn't study economics, so I think he's confused on a lot of things.
Can you send him your book?
Pardon?
Can you send him your book?
Absolutely. In fact, James Robison, my co-founder of the stream, actually visited him and gave him a copy of Money,
Greed,
God.
So good.
I don't know if he's ready yet.
Okay. But what was the name of your book again?
Money, Greed, and God.
It's good.
Just now being translated into Spanish, though. So when it's translated, maybe I'll send him another copy.
Okay, good. Yeah, but finish your thought. I'm sorry. I didn't mean to be glib.
No, and so I think it's important for Americans that hear him speak and say frustrating things on the climate or on economics. Don't think that he's a Marxist, but his views are more or less Peronist. And his economic views reflect, for good or for ill, the fact that he is from Argentina. And so, you know, I wish he would spend a little more time, frankly, studying economics and get better on that. But I think it's important to realize he's, you know, as the Pope, he is the head of the Catholic Church, which is not, it's an international church. And so it's not specifically an American thing. And so as Americans, we often hear things that he says and assume that he's talking about the American context when he's not.
Dr. J. Richards, how about a closing thought? And again, you can read his works at thestream.org. A closing thought. We've been all over the place. Let me just frame it this way. Are you optimistic or pessimistic about the future as far as America is concerned and specifically, conservative Christian values?
I'm optimistic. I think we're in for a very rough patch. But if you look at the history of the church, our fellow Christians have been through far, far worse and come out well on the other side. So I just think we need to be praying, we need to be reading and studying so that we can act and vote discerningly.
Amen. Thestream.org for more information. Thank you, Dr. Richards.
My pleasure.
Okay, you too. Bye-bye.